Mr. Kane is missing in action. Okay, I'm gonna. We'll get back to him. I just don't want to wait. So I'm gonna take next the 10-minute requested for Mr. Lowell Zielinski. Oh, there he is. Sorry, he just arrived. Okay, so the way we're gonna approach this, because I want to make sure we. You know, we're as efficient, but yet transparent and fair with everyone as possible. But, you know, in the previous session, we had a lot of back and forth with the speaker and then questions and answers and staff. At this rate, you know, we'll be here next week. So what I'd like us to do is, at this time, I will ask my colleagues to ask questions and clarifications. Staff will take notes of all these questions and clarification, and then we'll give respond in a block, because we have several other, you know, speaker cards of 30 minutes, 25, an hour. Otherwise, if we spend too much time of back and forth interaction, it's going to take an average of just 1.5 hours per. And I think it still makes it fair, and I see a show of agreement from my colleagues. So that's what we'll do. So we have time to reflect on some of the questions. I will ask also counsel to give a very brief observation, if you have any. But I'm looking at my left, and I'm looking at my right. Questions? Yes, Mr. Young. I'll start with Mr. Young. And
turned it on. There we go. All right. So your comment about advising us to put limits on nitrogen loading now, what would that look like? Are you suggesting a numeric? And what do you have in mind? What would it look like language-wise?
So I'm Nathaniel Kane for Environmental Law Foundation. I would suggest a numeric limit, and I think that the proposal that's been around these proceedings for several years has been to use the nitrogen applied number and the nitrogen removed number to come up with either a ratio or a difference. And I think in an ideal world, we would have a ratio of 1-to-1, where the crop can take up a certain amount of nitrate, and so you apply that amount of nitrate. And I think there's understanding for all of the parties to this proceeding that's probably not achievable in the very short term, and that a ratio of something more like 1.2 or 1.5 in the short term would allow some wiggle room for ag while still having a significant difference on nitrogen loading. And if we go back to the slide that was shown during the staff presentation, which I think was really evocative, the one that showed the application of nitrogen, including the nitrogen from irrigation water. If we had a ratio that was in the 1.2 to 1.5 range, you would lop off that right half of the graph, and that is and remember that graph was in terms of records and not in terms of acreage or pounds of nitrogen. So if you scale the graph so that the y-axis is pounds of nitrogen, then the right end of that graph is going to be really big, because all of those entries are going to have a lot more nitrogen per entry. So I think if you apply a ratio somewhere in that range, it would be reasonably easy to apply in that we have the nitrogen applied data already. we have the uptake data already, and it would be a number that could be applied without an enormous amount of regulatory burden in the short term. And I think it would have a significant effect on nitrogen loading.
Would that get in the way of our limitation on telling a grower how to achieve, you know, water quality compliance?
I don't think so. I don't think that we're telling growers what crops to plant. I don't think we're telling growers what brand of fertilizer to buy. I don't think we're telling growers how or when to apply it. I think we're just setting a limit on application. And you know, if this were a coal plant we're talking about that's that has a single outfall into a single water body, it would be easy just to measure the effluent in the discharge and set a performance standard, and then let them make all the decisions themselves about how to reach that. And I would be certainly open to listening to other proposals for how to do a pure effluent limitation in the agricultural context. But in this case, since we have a pretty good mathematical understanding of how nitrogen moves through the soil from application down through the soil into the aquifer, there isn't, I don't think, a big conceptual difference between having an application ratio and an effluent discharge. I mean, yes, you're measuring it on the front end instead of the back end, but it's really kind of the same thing. And I don't think that violates the restriction on requiring manner of compliance.
And the same question for pesticide use. You didn't make the same comment with respect mm-hmm. to that. I'm just curious if you have a position on that in terms of trying
I think
to...
I'm going to defer to Steve on that, Steve Shimek. He has more of a technical understanding of pesticides than I do. I think that we should be doing more on pesticides, and I'm just going to leave it there.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Johnson?
Yeah. Okay, a couple of... first of all, on photo monitoring, you urged us to keep the photo monitoring. What we hear from staff is that, frankly, they can do as... You know, they have the photos from the first round, but that basically at this point they can do as much or more using commonly commercially available satellite imagery, which is technology that's just stepped way up. Since what you're mostly monitoring is things like riparian buffer zones, why does it matter that much to you?
I want to clarify my comment there. I think I was trying to speed up to finish my. Within my time earlier. I'm not wedded to photo monitoring itself. I think if staff has a replacement that works, then I'm totally fine with a replacement that works. I just want to make sure that there's an actual enforceable requirement in the waiver that governs loss of riparian habitat and loss of wetlands. And I don't see in the text of the waiver a equivalent requirement.
Question. Photo monitoring. I get it.
Yeah, but I'm not married to photo monitoring in particular in any way.
And what do you see? I mean, obviously, we heard quite a bit from you about changes that were made after the comment period. Obviously, if we adopted your suggestion and did not adopt this waiver in the next day or two. And decided to make significant changes to it, that would then leave a period of no regulation. What's your view of the consequences or lack thereof of that?
You know, I think this gets at the general strategy that the board has adopted here. If we were talking about a 1-year interim to analyze the data that we had and come up with a regulatory strategy that controls discharge, I think we'd be having a very different conversation today. And I think my comments would have been a lot different. And I think that, you know, it's probably not realistic for the board to actually adopt the it might not be realistic for the board to adopt the proposal that I just gave to Mr. Young today or tomorrow. And I think that this might be a situation, if the board is interested in doing a short-term interim renewal that's much, much shorter than the term of this waiver, I'm not going to speak for any other group, but I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Yeah. And I would point out that the board, in coming up with the three-year period, postulated that as a maximum and directed staff to attempt to do that sooner. And I would like to hear from staff rather than Mr. Kane down at the point that it's appropriate on the reasoning behind the reduction in the list of high-risk crops. I believe you spoke to that briefly. I just want to – it doesn't have to be this minute, but I think that's important. That's all I've got.
Okay. So, Dr. Hunter?
Thank you, Mr. Kane. I agree with your comment on the lack of specificity on replacement water. I think you raised some really good questions, and certainly the staff report indicates that an emphasis and a priority for replacement water is the short-term solution. Are you aware of any efforts in other parts of the state where these questions are being looked at or these definitions are being created? Are we missing something? Because I think with so much effort and a priority for especially disadvantaged communities under the current situation with a lack of infrastructure and reliance on, you know, small private wells, it seems to me that we're all trying to look at the situation more globally, and maybe we're not aware, and you may be aware of places that are working on these issues. I certainly would like us to connect with that.
Yeah, I think there are numerous groups around the state that are working on this issue, and the, you know, the parallel Eastern San Joaquin process is also addressing these issues. And I know groups like Community Water Center, like Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, who's here today, are working on these issues really hard. I am, off the top of my head, I can't reel off a list of standards, but I can. I would be happy to submit a letter to the board with a roundup of everything that's out there.
That would be extremely helpful. Yeah, and I guess for staff, I just would like clarifications on your list of things for later comment. How does language about replacement water take shape along the lines of what he suggested in terms of the order? Because we do address it, we do include it. So is there, and this may not be 3.0, but I'm just trying to understand, can we be that specific in terms of defining what is replacement water, how much? I know we know of cases where people are completely reliant on every part for every type of water need is coming from bottled water. The water is so bad. So just any comments that staff can help clarify for me how that could be placed in an order. Thank you.
Okay, so I have one question, and this will be directed to staff in response to one of the comments you made. You stated that the written notification were implicit, but not explicit. So I'd like a little clarification on that point from staff, if you feel that It is embedded in there. Maybe we overlooked the wording. So if you can add that to your response, and as we agreed, this is your time now to respond back to comments that were made by Mr. Kuhn and also some of the questions and inquiries from my colleagues.
Very good. We'll start with Mr. Kuhn's comment with respect to the replacement water and Ms. Hunter's remark as well.
So Angela Schroeder, Regional Ward, Section Manager. I can respond to two of the questions that were brought up by Mr. Kane in terms of both the confirmation letters as well as the replacement water. So the confirmation letters, there is in the MRP a requirement for growers to send notification to the Regional Board of the exceedance as well as to notify the users of that drinking water that there's an exceedance within 10 days. And then to follow up with a confirmation to the regional board. Mr. Kane's correct, that doesn't specify written confirmation, although those words could be added. But from an implementation perspective, that's what's happening now. So the growers send a notification letter, they respond back to us that they've done the notification in writing, and then and if we don't receive that notification, we follow up with them. So that's how we're treating it currently. With respect to replacement water, on page 7 of the order, we do also have a finding that describes that drinking water is a priority for the region, and we reference 13304, which gives the board authority to require replacement water. Up until now, that is how we've handled it. So we haven't used the order specifically to require the provision of replacement water. We use Water Code Section 13304 separately and in site-specific situations. So with respect to what the requirement is to provide replacement water, how much replacement water, the method for both interim, i.e. bottled water, or a long-term treatment, all those things are articulated in the context of 13304 separate from this order, for example, in a cleanup and abatement order. I'm not sure how Region 5 handles it, but I don't believe that there is a regional board currently that is part of the ag order that is requiring growers to provide replacement water with any specific detail. It's usually in a separate action.
So if I can add to that, that comes by way of our enforcement team and our enforcement authority. Earlier in this discussion, I alluded to sort of this two-pronged strategy of control of the pollutant that is nitrate. That's coming through this order. And then through our enforcement arm, we're addressing the acute human health issue through replacement water and individual enforcement actions that are site-specific, as Ms. Schroeder alluded to.
Right. So I think the finer point here that was raised by Mr. Kane is the concept of how replacement water is structured, and in particular, I think he really struck a chord for me regarding whether that water is replaced at the home or the work site, or whether people are required to transport water from some central location, as in a truck that shows up and you have to provide your own container.
So our expectation, and I want to applaud Mr. Kane on his fluency on this issue too, as we've invested like a decade in this issue. Our expectation is that it is as though it was flowing from your tap, and its adequacy, and this is not just with respect to nitrate, this is with respect to all pollutants, including mm-hmm. perchlorate, for example, where we do replacement water, mm-hmm. Is that it is in quantities that are manageable for the user, too. An example being, if it's an elderly person, a 5-gallon bottle is not an effective way to deliver and would not adequately meet replacement water standards. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We dig down into the details when we require replacement water. It's not just getting water into a house. Is it getting there in a meaningful way and in an adequate way to replace what they don't have?
Okay, that helps for me to understand. Very separate tracks, but they're linked. It's triggered. Okay. Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. This is Chris Rose with the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. With respect to Mr. Kane's concern that the list of crops that are deemed high-risk crops has been reduced, that's wrong. It was simply a typographical error in the findings where the wrong list was in the findings. And so we had to shorten the list down to the actual list of high-risk crops. But the actual high-risk crops has not changed. And is there anything else the board would like me to address with respect to Mr. Kane's comments?
Let's kind of make sure we wrap up our question. So this is your
so photo monitoring
bite of the apple.
Up until now, I didn't know there was any. I saw some in the comments, but not strong opposition to that. So can we get from aerial sensing what we expected to get from photo monitoring?
I believe so. Yes.
Okay. Do you agree?
Like I said, I'm agnostic on the method. As long as there's a requirement to protect riparian areas and loss of wetlands.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, and in my case, I have religion, using your analogy, where, you know, these technologies are commonly used, and it's a matter of fact, most counties and cities use those for enforcement code because they can get down to a skylight at your house or an illegal deck that you built in the back of your house. And the satellite imaging is actually banked, so you can compare and contrast over time. So at this time, I would like thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I would like to bring Mr. Zielinski, who has exchanged his 10 minutes with Kay Mercer. Thank you.
Good afternoon, board, and thank you for allowing me to...
10 minutes, please. Thank you.
I'm looking to see if it comes on. Okay. For allowing me to switch my time with Kay Mercer's time, we'll cover different topics, but first, a little bit of background about myself. I have a PhD from the University of California at Davis. It's in soils and plant nutrition and irrigation management. I worked in agriculture in the United States and California for about the last 30 years. I consult on about 50,000 acres in the region on Regional Water Quality Control Board compliance. So I'm fairly familiar with especially Tier 2 and Tier 3 compliance. And finally, I was on the statewide expert panel for nitrates. So give you background. I have a couple of concerns. Oh, before I go there, I want to say thank you to Chris and his staff. They've been very easy to work with, very beneficial, very receptive to any comments and suggestions I have, and they worked out really well. I do have a list of items I'd like to read and then go back to. The one that Chris and I have talked about a lot is the loading requirement for the Irrigation Nutrient Management Plan effectiveness reports. I want to talk about that a little bit. I also want to make some comments on the complexity of the nitrogen cycle and the fate of nitrogen that is applied. I don't think it's as simple as a lot of engineers want to think that it is, and so I'd like to discuss that for a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the presentation that staff made about residual nitrate or residual nitrogen and stuff like that. And then also want to make a couple quick comments on the shortage of technical service providers. There really aren't very many of me out there. So and increasing the number of ranches from 600 to 1,700 is going to be really good for me, but I don't know if it's going to be really good for other growers. And then finally, I want to say something about the water use reporting and the TNA reports. So I think I might start with the complexities of the nitrogen cycle and the fates of applied nitrogen. You might want to take the simplistic approach that if you use the numbers that they set for lettuce, about 170 pounds of N would be the maximum removed. I don't know exactly what the number was now. And somehow our fertilizer addition or nitrogen addition should match that. Well, in part of my PhD dissertation, I applied nitrogen to cotton, fertilizer nitrogen to cotton, and measured the amount of that nitrogen that was taken up into the plant. And it turned out to be about 50%. And this was cotton's a very deep-rooted crop. It's long season. It's not over-irrigated typically in the San Joaquin Valley. So that level of uptake of nitrogen is at least comparable. Can we do better? Yes, I think we can do better, especially with the advent of drip irrigation. But 50%, 60% of the applied nitrogen is taken up. They also, in the presentation that Chris made, talked about what we call harvest index, which is the amount of nitrogen amount of nitrogen removed from the crop versus the amount of nitrogen in the above-ground biomass. You don't harvest the whole thing, so you need to apply more nitrogen than what is removed with the harvestable component. And in addition, they only talked about the above-ground biomass, which doesn't include the root system. For certain crops like spring mix, root system's probably not all that large, but when you go back to broccoli, it is that large. And so you have to keep that in mind. Additionally, the amount of nitrogen occurs in various forms in the soil and in the world and stuff like that. And it moves back and forth between the different forms. There's nitrate, there's ammonia, there's amino forms, there's proteins and stuff like that. And all that is controlled by biology. There's microorganisms that make all these changes. And those microorganisms, the bacteria primarily, are susceptible to anything that would affect the growth of anything. So if it's hot, they grow faster. If it's cold, if it's freezing, they don't grow at all. If it's dry, they're pretty not doing anything. If the soil is saturated and we don't have a lot of oxygen in the soil, then we can actually go from nitrate, which is the pollutant of concern, to a more what they call reduced form, like amino groups or ammonia or even the nitrogen gas. Next, I'd like to talk about the loading question. It's pretty easy to believe or understand or accept that agriculture has been in the Central Coast, it's about been applying more nitrogen than has been taken up by the crops, and it's moved to the groundwater. And we can say that for the whole region, or we can say that for the Salinas Valley, or we can say it for Santa Maria. But I think it's very difficult to make the same finding for a particular grower or a particular field or a particular crop. Like I mentioned, nitrogen goes back and forth between different forms. And to say that it's that this grower is has a loading amount of nitrogen of this many pounds per acre per year or something like that is really difficult on an individual grower basis. And as a matter of fact, I don't think it can be done. It's that complex. So I know that's a portion of the ag order, and I would suggest we remove that portion. I don't think it would change anything as far as water quality improvement. The on the charts that they had, and Nathaniel had a good point, each of the histogram, every record, so every reported of lettuce, was it equal? They weren't weighted by the number of acres. So if that 700 pounds of N on the lettuce represented 1 acre, and the 20 pounds of N on the lettuce represented 10,000 acres, that came out to be about the same on the chart. So I'd say take the chart with a grain of salt. Then finally, I want to talk a little bit about the water use reporting on the TNA. It's done on a whole ranch basis, okay? It's not done on a crop basis. And there are certain crops, spring mix, is in the ground for about 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, gets a whole lot less water than broccoli gets. So it's hard to know how much N was actually given to the lettuce by adding the amount of N in the water that was reported on the TNA report. And then finally, they mentioned that the nitrogen in the irrigation water is equally available. Or is available. And that possibly is true, but not necessarily true. One of the things we see with high nitrate groundwater is that it's also high in other salts. And those other salts inhibit the uptake of that water. So it's very possible that the amount of N in your, or the amount of nitrate reported in your well water is less than is what really is, you mentioned, bioavailable. So, and finally, I worry a little bit about the quality of the data on the TNA reports. I think it's been commented on that 14, there was a lot of confusion on there, and I'd agree with it that 100%. There were some reports of N applied that if that much nitrogen had been applied, the crop would be dead. So I know there must be errors in there somewhere. And then, again, finally this time, I want to make a comment on the number of records that I have to look at to prepare irrigation nutrient management plans, TNA reports, stuff like that. Most of the growers I deal with are fairly good-sized growers. They're the 5,000 to 6,000, 7,000 acre grower size. And we look at, for irrigations, nitrogen applications, plantings, we look at about 60,000 records per farm. Okay. And so you can imagine that keeping track of all those records is difficult. I appreciate the spreadsheets that they've developed, but they wouldn't work for 60,000 records. So, and now I've got, say, about 8 or 9 clients, so now I've got 500,000 records to look at. So I just want to impress upon you that this issue is complex, and I don't know if the board does this, but can they get consultants to help them understand the biology of certain of the nitrogen cycle and stuff like that? Because I think it's not an engineering approach. It's not a point discharge type of a question. So it's much more difficult, much more nuanced than that. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. So at this time, questions. I'll start with Dr. Hunter.
I'm sorry, I missed your name at the beginning.
Sure, it's Lowell Zielinski.
Thank you, Mr. Zielinski. So I take your point that there's more to it than just the engineering. And having participated in the expert panel, what can you share with us? What insights can you share with us about how that panel worked at these issues to consider these complexities?
That's a good question. My biggest thing I took out of serving on the expert panel was that the government needs to ask growers questions that they can answer and answer with confidence. Growers don't know how much nitrogen is removed with a crop. I do because I've done it as part of my career. But to ask them to estimate, and this would go back to the applied versus removed ratios, the growers aren't going to know the removed ratios or the removed component. And more than that, they're not going to want to give it to you anyway because then that will let you figure out how much yield they had. So the expert panel's primary recommendation, at least that I took away, was have growers report what they can report. They should all know, and it's be surprising that they don't all know, but they should all know how much nitrogen they apply per acre per crop every year. That should be the one thing that if we can follow that, we can accomplish it. I think we do need to make some estimates as is it a reasonable amount, but that's not too hard. And then don't make them come up with other things that they're basically just guessing at.
Thank you. Mr. Young?
So do you agree that there's been an excess of nitrogen being applied to irrigated lands?
In general, yes. Okay. In specifics, I can't say yes.
Right. So generally, yes.
Yes.
And what's your suggestion on how the Water Board eventually tries to ratchet that down or control that or regulate that such that we get towards a reduction of nitrogen getting into groundwater?
I think that basically the approach the board is taking is pretty close. If you keep monitoring very closely and eventually, I'll get shot for this, making the growers justify why they made this amount of nitrogen applied. I think most of them have good reasons, but we do that with pesticide applications now. Every time you make a pesticide application, you have to say, we did it because the pest is here. With the nitrogen and fertilizer application, we can say, we did it because we believe, we have samples that tell us that we're going to be short of nitrogen at harvest. So I think requiring growers to report how much N they applied, looking at it to make sure it's reasonable, and that sounds hard to quantify, but it's really not. If I have a grower and they're applying more than 400 pounds of N, 500 pounds of N for a crop, that's too much. That's unreasonable. It's simple. I lost the last little comment I was going to make. So
would you agree with a ratio? Some type of a ratio as being kind of a metric to use?
Yes, no. Well, I think maybe internally with the board staff, they can have a ratio that they can apply. But I think to require a grower to submit the ratio based on his experience in his ranch, well, it's going to be wrong no matter what. But I think as a guideline that the board and their board staff can say, okay, we grew lettuce, 200 pounds of N is required. We'll give them some efficiency factor. So in that way, I don't really mind the ratio. But to require a grower to provide the ratio to you or to the staff, I think doesn't make sense.
No, I mean, we provide the ratio. We say that if you're going to grow lettuce, then this is going to be the ratio that we're going to hold your feet to the fire on.
Right. The problem I have, I think it does kind of make sense, except that then you're telling the growers how to farm, right? And I'm under the impression that the board can't do that. They can require you not pollute, right? But they can't tell you how to farm.
Well, and I know that's your opinion on that, and we heard a speaker before say that would probably be permissible in his opinion. So I'm not sure whether it does go too far or doesn't go too far. I'm just looking for the tool for us to use at some point that we can start to get our hands around this and achieve compliance with what we are mandated to, you know, seek compliance with. And so I don't know that just asking growers to justify their use of a certain amount of nitrogen each year would get us there.
I thought I heard somebody, again on staff, say that if you have growers who apply a lot more nitrogen than is necessary, and I think you can come up with what is more or less necessary, then I think the board staff has every reason to ask them, well, why are you so different than everybody else? Why can your neighbor grow lettuce with 200 pounds and you have to put on 400 pounds? And they may have a good reason. I don't know what that might be. Maybe they put it all on one time of the year versus spread it out throughout the season. And if they spread it out throughout the season, they could get by with a lot less. But no, I think that's kind of the tool I would use is the report in applied and then down the road justify why that rate, and then finally have the board or the board staff investigate the ones that are unreasonable.
Thank you.
That's great.
Okay, sorry. So how then, I guess just to, again, try to call down this issue, how would you incentivize that? I mean, the point is we have to put protections in place. We also do not want to be prohibitive in tying anybody's hands, any grower, he or she. How do we incentivize people to find either water or soil bioavailability or not over-apply nutrients when there doesn't need to be? I mean, there's got to be some economic advantage to not applying more nutrients.
And You bring up a good point about the incentivizing. I think believe it or not, from my experience, by the board expressing a real, real concern about this. It has already made huge changes in the amount of N applied and the way it's applied. When I worked for the University of California as an extension agent 100 years ago, and I did a lot of nitrogen trials. The only thing I was concerned with at the time was maximizing yields, putting on enough fertilizer that there's no way I didn't maximize. Plus, like again Chris said, a little bit for insurance. I think that whole discussion has changed now. There's more to it than that. I think the grower community is much more aware that nitrate in groundwater is a problem, and they are the ones who can will have to be the ones to solve the problem because they're this is great. They're the source of the problem, really. So they have to. Then I'd also say if you've come up with growers who seem to be out of line or unreasonable in amounts of N applied, they need to be scrutinized. And I think those and avoiding that scrutiny is an incentive. So do it monetarily? I don't know. That's a kind of a tough one. The one of the things I would like to see is I know each county reports how much fertilizer is used in that county. No, how much fertilizer is sold in that county. The fertilizer may go someplace else, but it would sure be nice if Monterey County, we could go back and say, okay, for the last 10 years, you know, our reduction in nitrogen fertilizer applications has, our tons of fertilizer applied has been by this much. I think that would help you guys, the board, figure out, are we going the right direction?
Okay. Mayor Delgado?
One question for Lowell, and then I had several questions for staff. Do you want me to hold the questions for staff later and just ask the question to Lowell?
Yes.
All right. Lowell, you talked about the slide 21 that showed the 20 pounds to over 600 pounds applied. And I didn't understand what your point was when you mentioned you could do 20 pounds over 10,000 acres or 600 pounds for 100 acres. And that. So we should take the chart with a grain of salt. Can you explain that so I can understand it better?
Sure. The y-axis was the number of records that went into the height of the bar. It had nothing to do with the number of acres those records represent. So one record might be, let's say it was a quarter of an inch high. One record was that high. That quarter of an inch was equal if it represented 1 acre or if it represented 1,000 acres. So I think in that sense, the chart's a little misleading. You don't know if the and this gets nuanced too, what the median level of nitrogen applied was. If you looked at the way the chart looked, it's not what we call normally distributed, so the average rate of N doesn't make any sense. We need to look at what was the most common rate, or like these guys have pointed out to me, the weighted average of what was applied rather than the actual mean. Because it's, I always tell people, if you and I and Bill Gates lived on the same street, the average income would be really high, but the median income wouldn't be there. So.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Johnston?
My colleagues have done an excellent job of asking all of my questions.
I'm impressed. And a question I have for you, your perspective on the impact to N in soil, because we have a big discussion about residual, mm-hmm. you know, as it relates to the soil health, specifically microbial activity, bacterial activity, and as it becomes increasingly recognized, you know, the importance of carbon in the soil. And what I'm trying to drill out of this is a bit when we talked about residual and then eventually, well, hypothetically, if you got X amount of water, you know, it's going to go in the ground. Well, there's some other things that goes on before that happens. So I would like to hear your scientific perspective on that.
I think you got to unfortunately look at it at two levels, right? If we look at it at the Monterey County or the Salinas Valley or one, I think, you know, saying that the nitrate in the root zone, for the most part, is going to make it below the root zone and ultimately to the groundwater. Do I know how much? No. Can I know that for a specific grower, even if they're 1,000 acres? Can I know that? No, not for a specific grower, for a couple of reasons. One is the microbiology or just the biology, what's going on in the soil. And two is cultural practices continue to change. You know, if all my growers 5 years ago used sprinklers and they put on 2 acre-feet per acre, and now they've all switched to drip and they're putting on 1 acre-foot per acre, I think the magnitude or the change is different. So,
and you know, the reason I was trying to get a bit of your perspective, particularly on the carbon content, is that, you know, one of the techniques used for denitrification is bioreactors. Well, it's cellulose and carbon. And so if you have a carbon-rich soil, and I'm not, and we know not all soils are created equal, you know, you do have these variances. And right. So where I'm getting at is supporting the argument that this is not an exact science. So to make that point, when you perform the calculations for your clients, you know, I was asking earlier, what's your percentage of accuracy you think in the information? There's a range. So when you're saying you have to apply X amount of pounds per acre of N, you're still doing an educated guess.
Oh, 100%, yes. The one of the comments, again, about the bioreactors and stuff like that, it's not only the carbon source or the carbon level or the availability of the carbon to be decomposed, it's also the oxygen status.
Correct.
Of the soil. So if it's a waterlogged soil, how can I say this? If it's a waterlogged soil with no carbon, denitrification is not going to occur. If it's a highly organic soil that's bone dry, no nitrification is going to occur. So, like I say, it's just complex. It's a lot of things that have to work together. And a couple of my clients are going to talk with a company that does provide small bioreactors. Now, in the 50-gallon per minute range, that to me is a small bioreactor. And it made me think about the bottle or replacement water. If the bioreactors at that level, which is kind of the household supply level, that's even way more than a household supply, if they could put in the little bioreactors, which are about the size of a 55-gallon drum, you know, maybe that would be a replacement water solution also.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
At this time, Mr. Mayor Delgado, you had a question for staff?
Yeah, regarding Lowell's comments, he mentioned that only 50% of the applied nitrogen is taken up under certain circumstances. Does that affect, what effect does that have on staff's recommendations for interpreting slides 21 and I'm sorry, slides 16 and 17?
Yeah, thank you. Chris Rose, Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. It doesn't affect what we're proposing for the total nitrogen applied requirement. It may, however, affect how we would go about following up with a grower.
All right. And similarly, he mentioned that some crops, such as broccoli, the roots are a significant portion of the biomass residual. Does that have any effect on your thoughts about where we're going?
No, it doesn't. The residual that was calculated or estimated and provided in those slides include the entire biomass, which includes the root systems.
Okay, I didn't know that because I remember the picture shown was the above ground tissue, and so I wasn't sure.
Right. Yeah, that was just give the board an idea of what is meant by biomass. So that was just the surface. So.
All right. Can you respond to the grain of salt comment by Lowell about the records and not the acres?
We've presented the histograms and the graphs in many different formats. We thought that the way that they're provided here is just one sort of way of looking at the total nitrogen applied, and then so that the board and the public could see sort of in one or two slides the level of nitrogen application. There are other ways to look at the data, like on an acreage basis. For example, the 600 pounds applied, was that on a 1,000-acre farm or was that on a 50-acre farm? Yes, of course, there's ways to express that data. Nevertheless, the proposed requirement really isn't changed by that. We have all those graphs, we have all the information, and we've looked at it in many different ways, such as the way Mr. Zielinski suggested.
All right, and then the issue of the nitrate coming out of the irrigation water may not be bioavailable if the total dissolved solid is also high. Does that have any effect on your thinking?
Not really. We addressed this earlier when Ms. Baracarte said, when somebody point blank asked, so if somebody has high nitrogen in their water, if they have less, if somebody has high nitrogen in their water, does that automatically mean then that they can basically use that to essentially fertigate with that water? And the answer is it depends. And one of those things that it depends on is the salinity and the potential of the plant to uptake that nitrogen. Nevertheless, from a biological standpoint, that nitrogen that is in that water is bioavailable purely from a chemical standpoint. The question is whether the crop can pick it up.
Okay. And we've heard a couple of speakers, Lowell and I think Claire, mentioned that those high applications shown on those slides were so high in nitrogen applied that they would have killed the crop or blown out the broccoli heads, something of that sort. Is that true in your estimation?
I'm not an agronomist, so I'm going to defer to Mr. Zielinski on that. However, with those high application, particularly with those high application total nitrogen applied reports, we verified it with these growers that indeed that's how much they use. It's possible that they made an application of nitrogen, a rain event came along, or they over-irrigated, as you say. I mean, these things can happen, like Mr. Zielinski actually said, unless you came in afterwards with a lot of water. But could that happen? Yes, we believe that it did happen.
All right.
Without it killing the crop.
Thank you.
Well, can I follow up one real quickly? In my analysis of all the data, when I see a real high nitrogen application, it's usually a typographical error in the accounting side. It's not usually a real event. So then I kind of go back and say, no, you didn't really put on 2,000 pounds of N per acre. You meant 200 pounds, right? So that's
right.
Keep that in mind also, I guess.
And we are, and I've understood that today and before today that they've gone back with those growers multiple times when there seemed to be an anomaly. And so I think what they're reporting to us is what they think have been well-vetted figures, but I was just confirming that, trying to. Lastly, their suggestion by Lowell was that if more biological understanding was needed, could we get the help? And I'm sure we can get the help, but my question is, do you staff think that we need some any guidance on the biology of crops for better understanding?
To our knowledge, we have about 128 CCAs, sort of our crop advisors, in our region right now. Could we use more? Yes.
No, I'm sorry. I thought he was talking about the water board staff. Could use a better understanding of the biology of crop.
Could we?
Are you saying no?
I'm searching for why. Of course, more knowledge is always better. Sure.
So I'm going to answer that by saying we actually have a certified crop advisor on our staff, Monica Baracarte, and we have three agricultural engineers on our staff, if I'm not mistaken.
Two for sure.
Yeah, and Leah.
I'm sorry.
Leah?
No, she's in environmental engineering.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I think the gist of the comment was engineering is different than biology, and engineer thought is different than biological thought, and that perhaps we could get some help on the biological. So I was just following up to see if that was true, and I'm hearing staff say that we're where we need to be, or in a realistic fashion, where we need to be biologically. Is that true?
Yes, it is. I think the two staff that we have on this project are highly trained in this area.
Okay. Thank you.
Excuse me.
Could you please slow down for our court reporter so she can catch every word that you say?
Sorry.
Both sides. Thank you.
All right. So any other question here? Okay.
It's John Pierre, one last comment. The staff has been very receptive in listening to my ideas about biology and stuff like that. So I give them lots of credit.
Yeah. And before, you know, staff provides response, you know, one thing that I want to take this opportunity is to, you know, thank you for having volunteered to be on the expert panel, because I don't think a lot of people realize how much commitment that was, because you were on the roadshow in many, many places giving presentations and at state board. So,
thank you.
You know, I wanted to take this opportunity to, you know, thank you again for your help, you know, they, I think it helped not only Region 3, but, you know, the takeaways from the expert panel certainly are being leveraged across all regions for, you know, their future considerations of ag-related orders. So thank you for that.
Okay.
Mr. Rose?
Thank you, Chair. I really don't have much to add other than, again, thank you to Mr. Zielinski. Likewise, it's been a pleasure to work with Mr. Zielinski. One of the things that we did discuss with Mr. Zielinski with one of his clients is about the effectiveness, the Irrigation Nutrient Management Plan Effectiveness Report. The effectiveness report is different than the actual Irrigation Nutrient Management Plan. We did alter the language in the monitoring reporting programs about the effectiveness report to try to comport with our conversation that we had, and I think we found some common ground where we think that we could meet our needs and yours as well. And thank you for that conversation earlier, probably I think it was in February. Again, I want to thank Mr. Zielinski also for, quite frankly, saying things like that the awareness of the total nitrogen applied is taking a positive effect. And that is part of the reason for the total nitrogen applied requirement, grow awareness.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. So next, there's a request for 30 minutes. And I'm going to ask Ms. Monica Gremlin to be the coordinator, because there are several speaker cards associated with your presentation. I'm going to put you 100% in charge of the order, who starts. So you lead. And my question, you know, looking at the cards that we have here, you didn't state if all your presentation requires bilingual or only part of it. It's totally your choice.
No, we had one, just one speaker, but we're not going to
okay,
need
so
the translation.
When we'll have the one speaker, you know, we'll add extra time. So if, you know, the 30-minute expires, don't worry about it. You know, we'll extend it a bit.
Okay.
Make it convenient for you.
Okay. Sorry, just testing it. Good afternoon, Chair Wolf and members of the board. Would like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak here today and for granting us additional time. My name is Monica Gurmilan, and I'm the Central Coast Outreach Specialist for the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. EJCW works with disadvantaged communities affected by high nitrate levels in their drinking water wells throughout the Salinas and Pajaro Valleys. I'm here today with fellow EJCW staff, partner organizations, and community members to present a united front and to show your board and everyone present what current agricultural practices have done to local drinking water sources, particularly in disadvantaged communities, and how these drinking water sources will continue to deteriorate unless an ag order is adopted which truly enforces the law, holds polluters accountable, and helps solidify the human right to water. The communities that we'll be speaking of today are not the only communities we are working with which are affected by nitrate contamination. They are a very small but clear representation of what this area is currently dealing with. Today I will review the most recent drinking water quality results we have acquired from Monterey County Environmental Health for four of EJCW's high priority sites. These results are for local and small water systems. It is important to note that the information I will be providing does not include private drinking water wells, which are also highly affected by high nitrate contamination. We want to review this information to highlight the urgency of stronger monitoring and regulations as a means to ensure and protect safe drinking water sources and thus reinforce the human right to water. The communities listed above are located throughout Monterey County and suffer from varying degrees of nitrate contamination. All of these communities listed are located in very close proximity to large agriculture fields. All of these levels are above the state MCL, the maximum contaminant level. And I also wanted to note that we are also working in several communities where there are small water systems that are very close to the MCL. So that it's just a little concerning because at the rate that these nitrate levels are going, they will surely be above the MCL in a matter of no time. Hudson Landing Road is located in the city of just down, actually not too far from here. This water system has not been under the state MCL since 1994. Since its first exacerbated increase between 1994 and 1996 from 5 milligrams per liter of nitrate as N to 38 milligrams per liter of nitrate. This community has seen very small but steady changes in their drinking water quality. The last sample tested from Hudson Landing Road was in September of 2015, and that was 40 milligrams per liter of nitrate as N, making that four times over the state MCL. The previous sample just 2 years prior in 2013 was 31 milligrams per liter. Middlefield Road is located in the city of Salinas in a large suburban neighborhood, which highlights the fact that rural water systems are not the only ones affected by nitrate contamination. Water system number 4 in Middlefield Road has seen small increases in their nitrate levels. Nevertheless, in a matter of 3 years, the community has seen the nitrate level exceed the state MCL. Their last sample was collected March of last year, and that was at 13 milligrams per liter of nitrate. Scotch Road is also located in the city of Salinas. El Camino Real water system number 34, their last sample was collected in May of 2014, and that read at 14 milligrams per liter of nitrate as N. The past decade's steady level well below the state MCL. This drastically changed between 2008 and 2014 when Scotch Road suffered a huge increase, going from just 2 milligrams per liter to 14 milligrams per liter of nitrate as N. The last community I will be speaking of is Walnut Avenue Water System Number 2. This is located in a small farm in the city of Greenfield. This community has seen their nitrate level double in the last 3 years. The last sample collected was in May of last year and displayed a level of 36 milligrams per liter of nitrate as N, over three times the state MCL. This is a small community of six households where the majority of its residents are young children and nursing mothers. Prior to EJCW providing interim bottled water for this community, many of these residents were using their tap water for cooking and drinking, and even in their baby formula. This is just one community. How many more are there in these same circumstances, unaware of their poor and dangerous drinking water quality? We urge you to adopt an ag order that will protect the residents of Walnut Avenue and the countless others affected by nitrate contamination. A strong order must require stronger monitoring and more frequent testing. Results of these testing practices should be available and easily accessible for the public so that people like the people here on Walnut Avenue would know that their water quality wasn't good. Dischargers should also fund replacement water to these communities. And I echo what Mr. Kane said earlier on also having us determine a particular defined amount and whether or not the replacement water also covers delivery as well. All the monitoring and assessment practices need to lead to solutions. More information will not help us unless we use it to enforce laws and increase regulation. Polluters and dischargers need to be held responsible for the cost of all the environmental remediation. Communities, especially disadvantaged communities, are the ones bearing the cost of the pollution. They are paying with their health and their limited financial resources. The most vulnerable populations will continue to suffer from the nitrate contaminated water if the ag waiver is approved as proposed. I wanted to quickly read a section from the Human Right to Water that really echoed with myself and with our overall mission at EJCW. The Central Coast Water Board will promote policies that advance the human right to water and discourage actions that delay or impede opportunities for communities to secure safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes. It is important for us to ask ourselves, does the current ag waiver seek to promote this, or will it be yet another obstacle for these disadvantaged communities to secure safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human cooking, consumption, and sanitary purposes? Thank you.
Good afternoon, board members. I just want to share a little bit of our experience in the community of San Gerardo. When we were in that community, we built that community because we didn't have no houses. So that was our main problem in 1974, 77. By 1990, there was the agriculture industry was starting to producing more instead of having, you know, like in places where you don't use pesticides or fertilizers. And in my experience was in Mexico, we didn't use pesticides or fertilizers, and we produced very good food. And we just used the water of the sky, because we didn't have no wells. But when we came to the United States, we started using synthetic fertilizers, pesticides. And it was only one crop, mostly two crops a year. Now technology is going forward. There's good growers, and there's also bad growers. You know, the good growers, they try to have the best practices that you can implement in farming, and that's good. Problem is when people are starting to put so much fertilizer that it's contaminating our groundwater, and the disadvantaged communities, like in the San Gerardo case, we were not able to move, and all our wells, our three wells, were contaminated. And the last one, the very last one, in 2001, it was also contaminated with TCP, with the counts with pesticides. So we have to wait 10 years to get clean water. And it was thanks to the county that helped us, the state water board that helped us, the federal government that helped us. And now we have clean water. But we're paying over 500% of what we used to pay when we used to pump the water in our property. And just like San Gerardo, there's a lot of communities, they have to live there. They have to shower with contaminated water, and they have to go and get water outside, you know. So, and it's worse for children, from little children and older people. So, I wish that there was no regulations for the farmers, but it's necessary, because if we don't regulate the water is going to get so contaminated the way it's going, that pretty soon it's going to affect everybody. By now it affects the people that they cannot move. They have to live there because they have no choice. They cannot go and from one day, I'm going to move. Can't. And that's what happened to San Gerardo. We were almost to the point that we were getting evicted because the synthetic fertilizers and the pesticides contaminated our water, and we almost got evicted. That's not the right thing. It's not the right thing to do. So it's better that we all have good water for everybody, and we must protect the water at any cost. You know? Not for profits. We start producing 3-4 crops a year, we're going to increase the amount of fertilizer and the amount of pesticides. So I know you have a very hard thing to deal with, because California is huge, you know? And the water contamination that is happening in California and other parts of the world is huge. But if we don't protect the water that we carry in our bodies, that we use every day, now it's going to be a bad way of living, especially for the future generations. So I support the work that you guys are doing, because it's hard choices that you have to do, and it's difficult because there's so many stakeholders. But I support clean water for everybody. Thank you.
And Horacio, would you mind, for the record,
yeah, my name is Horacio Mezquita.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Board. My name is Lucia Calderon, and I'm here with EJCW today, but I also represent a group called Safe Ag, Safe Schools in South Santa Cruz County and Monterey County. And we're a group of farm worker and farm worker advocates, teachers and teacher union leaders, organic farmers, healthcare professionals, and students. And we're concerned about pesticide use in the urban agricultural interface and the pollution it causes and the health risk associated with this pesticide pollution that's affecting predominantly the Mexican-American communities here, and especially children, because their bodies are more vulnerable to health harms from pesticide exposure because of the larger amount of air that they breathe in and water that they take in, et cetera, per unit of per pound of body mass. And one issue that we have really faced in this pesticide reform movement is the issue of the pesticide treadmill, and that's when one or two pesticides are spotlighted for regulation, and growers' use changes to another type of pesticide that is less regulated, and often these new pesticides that come onto the market, while being less regulated, they're often more toxic and persist longer in the environment. And so I wanted to talk about the proposed ag waiver today and tell you that I believe the proposed 2017 ag waiver really fails to adequately regulate pesticide discharge. And it's because by spotlighting only two pesticides, chlorpyrifos and diazinon, they're pesticides that are falling out of use already. The Water Board has really left the door open for pesticide switching
or as I mentioned, when growers switch to using a less regulated pesticide to avoid that regulation. And this can be seen already in the increased use of pyrethroids and neonicotinoids, which are more toxic and more persistent than organophosphates. And I'm not only talking about toxicity to insects or wildlife, but I'm talking about toxicity to humans. The human health harms of the neurotoxic organophosphate class of pesticides are really well documented in the scientific community.
Could you slow down just a little bit? Because
I'm sorry,
see smoke coming out of our keyboard. Thank you.
All right. So I'll start and say that the pesticide switching has been seen in the increased use of pyrethroids and neonicotinoid pesticides, which are more toxic and more persistent than organophosphate pesticides. And I'm not only speaking about toxicity to insects and wildlife, but toxicity to humans, the health harms, human health harms associated with neurotoxic organophosphate use are well documented in the scientific community. We have UC Davis science that links organophosphate exposure to autism, UC Berkeley science from the Salinas Valley itself that links organophosphate exposure to respiratory system, respiratory symptoms, decreased IQ, attention problems, and other developmental delay. And pyrethroid and neonicotinoid pesticides, while less researched, exhibit similar modes of action. And the harms of chronic exposure to a combination of pesticides, for example, organophosphates, neonicotinoids, and pyrethroids in the water, are largely unstudied and unknown, but suspected to exponentially increase toxicity. And so if the Water Board wants to create an ag waiver that truly reduces the severe impairment, degradation of our water sources and protects the health of both wildlife and humans, the ag waiver must not spotlight specific classes of pesticides, but rather focus on toxicity in general. Organophosphates have been going out of use and are increasingly replaced. Other classes will also be replaced if they're spotlighted, and will be the replacements will likely be more toxic and less studied classes of pesticides. Another issue is that the 2017 proposed ag order is not enforceable and doesn't put limits on use or discharge. And it's extremely disappointing. I believe our communities deserve better. They deserve real regulation of these toxic chemicals that are so obviously polluting our water and will continue to under the ag waiver the way that it's written. If the board is to truly support the success of farmers in fostering a healthy environment and human population, it should focus on toxicity, not specific chemicals that will simply be replaced, and should implement a proactive protocol for monitoring for toxicity that informs and coincides with enforcement of specific limits on use and discharge. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Randy Reck. I'm the legal fellow at the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, and I appreciate you taking all day today to listen to comments and staff as well. I have a few points I would like to make, mostly regarding legal standards and how they apply to the proposed order. I think I should start out by quoting the Basin Plan, because that is what sets the legal standard for the Central Coast Basin. In relevant part, it says, "Wastewaters percolated into the groundwaters shall be of such quality at the point where they enter the ground so as to assure the continued usability of all groundwaters of the basin." And, of course, it also says that all groundwaters are available for domestic use. In more detail, the Basin Plan states that waste discharges to groundwaters shall be free of toxic substances in excess of applicable drinking water standards. And of course, for nitrates, well, excuse me, actually, it says for nitrogenous compounds, qualities which could result in a groundwater nitrate concentration above the MCL must be avoided. And I think in some of the discussions about the technical way in which nitrogen is transported from water and application of fertilizers into the ground through the root zone and into groundwater, perhaps this standard in the basin plan is being overlooked. It's the point where this water enters the ground that is most applicable. You know, that is something that is set in the basin plan. It's not something that is up to be changed here. That would be, of course, for a later proceeding. But it informs the discussion that we're having today. Along those same lines, of course, to reach the basin plan objectives, EJCW recognizes that it will be a difficult and iterative process to accomplish that. But you also must comply with the non-point source policy and anti-degradation requirements, as Mr. Kane very well laid out. One area of anti-deg that I'd like to focus on that we still believe is lacking in the current proposal, although there was an attachment made, I assume based on our written comments and others' written comments, that expanded that analysis. But it is still lacking in the maximum benefit for the people. This is a finding that must be made with this order. And in anti-degradation analysis, as outlined in AGWA, in weighing that benefit, you must look at both costs and benefits. Of course, regulating synthetic fertilizer application could impose a large cost or burden onto growers. We've heard about how a lot of growers are applying the amounts of fertilizer that they are to perhaps meet contractual requirements and to have as high of a yield as possible. In limiting, possibly limiting, someday, maybe, that application, those costs must be balanced with the costs that are currently being imposed on other community members. There are externalities associated with agriculture. Those externalities are currently being imposed on disproportionately people of color and low-income individuals. In making the findings of the maximum benefit to the people in passing this order and adopting it, you must make findings related and balancing those competing interests. Moving on, the non-point source policy includes more direction on how to meet the basin plan goals. I would like to highlight for that key element number 3, which requires a specific time schedule and quantifiable milestones towards achieving the basin plan objectives. These are not included in the order as proposed. The closest thing is a narrative objective saying that management practices will be improved upon until compliance with the basin plan is achieved. We do not believe that this complies with a non-point source policy. I think what we would like to see, perhaps in this order, or perhaps moving forward into the next Ag Order 4.0, would be, you know, beyond a specific time schedule for compliance with the basin plan, but a time schedule for staff to work on achieving a time schedule for compliance. This would mean, letting stakeholders know what staff is going to do between now and perhaps 2020, when a new order would at most be required, and we would like to see something done before then. But allowing that transparency of what staff is doing and what steps they are taking would increase our confidence in the process to know that the future Ag Order 4.0 will comply with all relevant legal standards. I'd also like to echo Mr. Keynes and Monica's sentiments about replacement water and how important that is for communities that are currently struggling with contaminated water. It's been emphasized over and over again that this is a temporary order. You know, it is basically a continuation of the current order with a few changes. To alleviate some of our concerns and to allow a temporary reprieve from contaminated water, we believe that there should be discharger-funded replacement water program. And whether you do this through the order or through enforcement actions is, of course, at the board's discretion. The only other small recommendation that I would have is in regards to the current monitoring of drinking water wells and any wells that can be used for domestic purposes. The letters are, I think, an adequate way to address the problem and to let community members know when they're dealing with contaminated water. But I would also like to see notification requirements posted at those well sites, if that is within the board's authority. Having a one-time letter sent is helpful, but having a reminder every time you go to a spigot that this water is not safe to drink is a different matter entirely. But we would like to see that change made. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So you do not have any additional speakers? Okay. All right. So thank you. And at this time, I will look at my colleagues for questions. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you to the group. I appreciate your perspectives, and thank you for organizing a range of aspects, areas that people are working on. It reflects on the broader set of issues. We know what the priority is, so But in particular, EJCW has taken on the work in this region and has helped to bring to light the kinds of information and details that we need to be more certain about what we're doing and to find ways to be more responsive. A couple of things, and there are many that I could talk about, but I think one thing that Monica, you may not have, I think we need to know where you are in terms of the replacement water program that you have now, and it links in with the comment made by the last speaker with the suggestion that there should be a discharger-funded replacement water program. I know the challenge, this regional board has provided some funding for interim replacement water for a small percentage of households, and I'm not up to speed or up to date on where you are with refunding, extending funding, not necessarily that we can provide, but other sources of funding, where you are in that.
We have spoken with Angela and Katie McNeil on perhaps extending some of those grants. And ideally we would like to be able to extend service for the people who are already receiving the bottled water, and also adding new recipients for a lot of the communities that we're working with that aren't getting any of the interim water at the moment.
So that suggests that you have data or you have an idea of locales that are likely exposed to contaminated water that you're not able to address at this time?
Correct.
Okay. And is it just you're looking at like hot spots and you're aware that these areas that may require testing, though, to demonstrate what the level of contamination is? Is that the status of that?
For the majority of them, we already have those numbers thanks to the Monterey County.
Okay, so so I guess the question is, of all of the households that you're aware of that are drinking, most likely consuming contaminated water, is there replacement water being provided right now, according to your knowledge, of how many households?
For our top high priority sites, the majority of the people there are on interim bottled water.
Okay. And
it's just in those that were perhaps in those same communities, but that exceeded the amount of funding that we had for that program.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there is a gap.
Correct.
In terms of what the program needs to do and what you can actually do at this time.
Right.
Right. So you're still seeking funding.
Correct.
And I'm aware of that. I wanted to hear an update on where you are on that. And I know that staff is also looking at every possibility for extending those funds or identifying additional funds. So the continuation of that replacement water is assured. I don't know what would happen or how would your program deal with the idea that these programs may end, funding may end. What do you have in your, as far as EJCW is concerned, are there any steps that you have already outlined that you would take if any of those households find themselves discontinued in the program?
I believe currently the main thing that we are attempting is to find alternative funding sources to be able to continue the program. And also, like I said, to be able to include more recipients. And I do want to say that we are very grateful for the help, and everyone that's currently receiving bottled water is extremely grateful to you and to your board for the help, especially because it's delivered to them, which is why we all really wanted to clarify and or to highlight that just having, you know, maybe that financial help of here you go, this for you to, you know, purchase your own water, that's not enough.
Right.
That we need to do more for people to to remove that burden from them.
Right.
Because they're not the ones causing the contamination, so they shouldn't be the ones carrying that burden. And like I mentioned, with one of the communities, a lot of them are families with very small children or elderly residents that are unable to perhaps, you know, carry those 5-gallon jugs. So we want to do more to facilitate that for them.
Well, again, EJCW is picking up a great burden in working with the community and helping to organize at least information, education, awareness. And I know that's another part of your program. So we all appreciate the partnership, if you will, in terms of getting the information to these communities. So the best we can hope for is to see continued funding and to look to the state in various ways that they've also identified this as a priority. And I know our state water board members have also joined us in learning from the community members themselves, and so the awareness is there. It's just now, can we actually keep the spigot open, if you will, for the replacement water? So thank you very much, Monica.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter.
I have one comment for staff. This is something that I think we have discussed before, and so I just at this point don't recall precisely where this issue of notification versus posting signs. I can tell you that if you get on an airplane and you move around that plane at all, you're aware of where you can get water and where you should not be getting water to drink. I mean, that just seems like a basic thing. I see it in different places in different ways, and I think wherever there is non-potable water in the vicinity of people working and living, and it appears to be a source of water, that posting a sign would alert everyone, not just the person who received the notification or the family residing where this water is in proximity to their activities. So if you could comment on that, because I think that is just another essential step. Where we are in that process of getting that signage in place is something I just don't recall right now, but I would like to hear more about that. So that's it for me.
All right, so on my left, any question?
Just a brief comment, similar to Monica's, at least in the appreciation to the environmental justice folks for coming to these meetings and speaking as you have today and previous to today. Thank you very much.
All right, so one question that I will have for staff is a brief comment, you know, in regard to the references that were made to the basin plan. So that would be my question to add to the response from staff. And I look at my left, my right, no additional question or comment. So, Mr. Rose, we're ready to hear from you.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. This is Christopher Rose of the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. Just real quickly, with respect to the pesticide switching and moving away from the OPs, the chlorpyrifos and diazinon, this is why we've updated the indicators in the monitoring reporting programs to essentially pick up toxicity that is caused from the pesticides that we know are being used in these areas. That's hence our monitoring reporting proposal. Let's see. Okay, with respect to the basin plan question and comment, as we said earlier, yes, we do have basin plan standards, and the non-point source policy gives us the means of gradually achieving those water quality standards. And this order is an iterative, it takes an iterative approach towards doing so. As we said earlier, there are milestones within the order itself. And so we think that we are compliant with basin plan standards insofar as we are iteratively, gradually achieving them.
Yeah. Sorry. Angela Schroeder, Section Manager at the Regional Board. I'm going to go ahead and respond to the questions regarding drinking water and the notifications. But before I answer those questions, I think it's important to make a distinction in terms of what Ms. Grimmillan presented. There are, you know, public water systems, small community water systems, and domestic wells. So if I'm not mistaken, much of what Monica presented here in her presentation related to small community water systems, she distinctly said that she was not talking about domestic wells. The R order requires domestic well testing from the private domestic wells that are on the farms and are enrolled in the order. Has anything to do with public water systems, community water systems, or even domestic wells outside of those acreage properties enrolled in the order. So it's a very small subset.
So specific to our subset that we regulate in our order, we do require growers to, and so the order explicitly requires growers to notify users within 10 days of learning of the exceedance. Now, the way we implement that is we follow up with the growers in writing, tell them they must conduct the notification and they must provide us with written confirmation within a certain period of time. And in addition to that, in our letters, it also says you must also do the posting. So we do require posting at any place where the water can be accessed for human consumption, cooking, or sanitary purposes. But again, this is only for domestic wells on enrolled properties. DDW has their own, Division of Drinking Water, and the County Environmental Health has their own posting requirements. So, for example, there are some rest stops or gas stations along 101, like near King City, where you can go into the restroom and it'll clearly say that this is not potable drinking water. So that's what we require in terms of the notification and posting. I also want to mention in response to Mr. Reck's comments that we also require dischargers to notify any new tenants. So that's a new addition from the previous Ag Water 2.0 that we are now requiring dischargers to notify if there's any change in tenancy.
And to further augment your statement, basically all of the community members who are outside of our Ag Order regulatory purview fall under the Drinking Water Division, which I would assume has, you know, their own set of requirements. True statement?
That's correct for the public water systems and for the community water systems. There's a subset of private wells that are not regulated by either.
Right. Okay. Thank you. All right. Any other addition, Mr. Rose? Okay.
No, Mr. Chair, nothing for me.
All right. So I'd like to thank your group for coming. Likewise, you know, we certainly appreciate the efforts all of you are putting forth. And Horacio, good to see you again. Thank you. So next we will have one item which I'm going to let's see. The next item is going to be an hour long. So do we need a quick little bio break, as we call it? So let's do that, and let's see, 10 past 4, and then what I'd like to do is the last item, it's going to be a 1 hour, and that will be your group, Mr. Shimek. That way you can organize this as it works best for you, and we will make that the last item for today, I think, because by that time, you know, we'll get close to 5:30 by the time we're done with question and answers. Sounds good? Thank you.